And this is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. And I could say a lot of stuff about the next guest, but I'm going to get out of the way and make room for a reading by author Angela Garbez.
I was raised by immigrants who came to America with very little and worked their way into the middle class. It feels shameful to admit that I don't have the desire to hustle up that same ladder. But that ambition has never existed in me, no matter how much or how long I hoped it would show up. My daughters will have fewer financial resources than I did, but I already know I have given them more of a sense of self and confidence and community than my parents, who spent years just surviving, were able to give me. Better or worse hardly feel like the appropriate ways to measure these versions of my family, but I know that I prefer the latter for my children. I could live only for myself, for my immediate family, following the expectations of my parents, whose survivor instincts align with this country's neoliberal ethos, which is to get ahead at the expense of anyone else while burying the shame that binds us, writes Kathy Park Hong. I'll admit that pursuing the community-oriented way of life I desire still feels strange at times. What I was taught doesn't easily give way to what I want. I find myself questioning if I can trust the connections I've made with people, if they are genuine. How could people I've known only a few years possibly understand and accept the person I've always been? But when I sit, breathe, let these thoughts pass through me, I'm left with my desire to be seen by others. My need to find better ways of being in relationship persists. So that is what I go with. Noli and Lagaya know how to spin a dreidel and swap coins accordingly. They know more about Jewish culture than I did until I was 19, when my freshman college roommate gave me a crash course over tins of hamantaschen sent by her mother. They have Filipinx classmates and brown-skinned teachers. For the earliest years of their lives, their authority figures were mostly women who spoke English as a second language. As of now, we have absolutely no idea how we would pay for orthodontia or their college educations if they decide to go. But right now, they have more than 10 grown-ups in their life whom they love and trust, who see them fully, and whom I would let discipline them without a thought. How can we show our children that even as social circles shrink, it is also possible to deepen dependence on family, neighbors, and even strangers? How can we instill the idea that all people are our people? The American dream is based on the idea that freedom is about being unburdened from others, having the power to do whatever we want, whenever we want. It is deeply individualistic. But as activist Mia Birdsong explains in her book, How We Show Up, Reclaiming Family, Friendship, and Community, there is an older understanding of freedom that we must rediscover. The words free and friend are derived from the Indo-European Freya, which means beloved. Freedom, Birdsong writes, was originally the idea that together we can ensure that we have all the things we need: love, food, shelter, safety. Freedom is not an individual effort, but a collective one. Being free, writes Birdsong, is achieved through being connected.
I have chills listening to you read that. Thank you for taking the time to do that. And you're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. That was Angela Garbez, an author, reading from her new book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. And Angela, thank you again for joining us and for sharing that reading. We are really grateful to have you here today.
Thank you, Libby.
So talk to me about what your life was like during the pandemic that sparked this shift to a more communal living. Why did you start that?
Yeah, well, like many people, the first 4 months of the pandemic, I was home, just at home, just me and my children and my spouse. And we were really kind of cut off from the rest of the world. Everything played out within the walls of our home and in the parks in our neighborhood. I was taking care of them 24/7. And it was hard. I did feel that that was the most important work I could be doing, right? Writing a book or doing a podcast. It sort of paled in comparison to knowing that keeping my family safe, and in that case, keeping ourselves away from other people, which would also be keeping our community safe, was the most important work I could be doing. But it became really clear that our mental health suffered and we couldn't do it alone. And that's something that I realized applies to life. You know, in our daily lives, I realized like we get by because we have childcare, right? We have these wonderful preschool teachers that my children had. We had play dates with friends. We had time that my daughters got to spend with my parents, their grandparents. And, you know, I derived creative energy from running into people, talking to people, dancing with people, touching people. And all of that was gone. But the thing that I think all of us realized in the pandemic was that we couldn't do it alone. And what we really saw was, to use the sort of, you know, very deep in the pandemic language, podding, right? Or, mm-hmm. you know, being part of like a pod with people. And to me, that was a way of acknowledging this is too much. I can't do this alone. I can't take care of my family and work and oversee virtual school. There's just, we're not meant to do these things alone. And that's the sort of the bigger thing that I started to grapple with. You know, we're organized in the United States around nuclear families, like our individual families. And I think we've sort of lost sight of how truly interdependent we all are around the world, globally. For centuries, we lived more communally. And we've really lost touch with that in modern American life. And I felt like it was a great gift to be able to discover that I needed my friends desperately. Mm-hmm. I needed them for myself and for my children, and I needed my family in that way too. The pandemic is not over, but as it starts to feel a little bit more in the rear view, I don't want to lose that. I don't want to lose that sense of community, that sense of care, that sense of collectivity that I found in the pandemic.
Do you think that this will be an inflection point for society, for more families? You wrote that during the pandemic, quote, the rage of mothers in America has been mighty. That rage has to go somewhere, right?
Yeah.
Is it going to create more shifts like what your family has seen, where you have connected with other families in similar circumstances and really extended your network in a way that makes raising your children more along the lines of communal efforts, like what, you know, we used to do in the past?
I hope so. I think so. I see it. I see it all around me. You know, I was just talking to someone who said, I developed a really close relationship with our pod family. And now that they're going back to soccer practice, and I think their life, their pod family's life is a little more scheduled than theirs. And she said, I miss them. I miss needing them.
Yeah.
I miss being with them. And I felt that. And I also said, you know, you're never going to stop needing them. And the other thing is, if they're busy, there's other families who I know would be so happy to spend time with you and your wife, you know? And I told her that. I was like, I think that, I think it is an inflection point, and I think all of us are realizing it. What I do think is that we're realizing it on a very personal level, like at the community level. And I think that's great, but I did think, you know, that idea of the rage of mothers being mighty, there was really this moment. And I think it was, you know, I think it was the fall of 2020 and kind of the beginning of 2021, when we were seeing all of these pieces, you know, like America doesn't have a social safety net. It has women and mothers, or women are not okay, right? And
yeah.
there are 2 million less women in the workforce now than there were at the beginning of the pandemic. So the thing that makes me sad, though, is I feel like we're losing some of that urgency. And some of that is because you know, in that moment, we weren't able, and I'm someone who has is also financially privileged enough to be able to outsource some care work, right? Preschool and babysitters, that kind of thing. But in the pandemic, none of us could do that. And people who were like really rich, who maybe had live-in nannies, right? Or nannies who came every day and house cleaners, they weren't able to have those support systems. And so I think a lot of people, and specifically a lot of women, realized no matter how successful they are, you know, outside of the home and their professional work, and how much they had sort of, again, outsourced that domestic labor in the pandemic, they were stuck doing it. And a lot of women realized, in terms of the male patriarchal world, we're kind of still in a condition of servitude, and figuring out all that stuff comes down to us.
Yeah, I mean, we saw this temporary flattening of the class divide of folks who can't afford to go outside the home for care or bring people in to help out. And when that wasn't possible, the true weight of what we pile on, especially lower income and yeah. so much women of color, the true weight of that became clear to women in a privileged spectrum as well.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's to be clear, this, you know, the child care crisis, as we, you know, are calling it, it existed. It predates the pandemic. And many of us have known that for a long time. And I really was inspired, though, because I was like, here's our moment. Here's our moment where now everyone sees it. Right. And I thought, and part of me writing this book is I was like, I want to take advantage of this moment. I never want to go back. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, it's we have gone back a little bit. There has been this backslide. When schools reopened, I think a lot of people were like, okay, phew, like my kids aren't home and now I can start rehiring people. And so some of that really righteous anger like has dissipated. And it's not just that, it's also that our government is saying you should go back to work, right? When the CDC was like, if you get COVID, you don't have to quarantine for 12 days anymore. You can just quarantine for like five. Mm-hmm. And those are not decisions that are made, you know, with public health in mind. I think that those are decisions that prioritize the economy. So I felt really, truly disappointed by that. And I felt really disappointed and a little disillusioned and angry that the Biden administration, who ran on paid leave, you know, and family leave, has not made those things happen. So
yeah, the expanded child tax credit was allowed yep. to expire. I mean, all sorts yeah. of things that stepped up during the pandemic have petered out.
Yes. And that's a failure of our government. You know, that advanced child tax credit, which did, in fact, lift 4 million children out of poverty for close to 6 months, they just let it expire. It had been funded for a full year. The funding was allocated. And they let it die. And so I don't know how to not be angry about that. Mm-hmm. And so I think what I've realized, though, is that I think a lot of people are still wanting that communal way of living, but feel like it's at odds with American culture, which is true. And so what I think is that we have experienced an inflection point. I think things are going to change. It's just that, like so many important social movements, it's going to take longer and it's going to be a harder fight. And that's disappointing to me. But I think that's the reality.
Well, your book does feel like a rallying cry and a point to channel that righteous anger about the state of how we treat caregivers and how we treat mothering in America. The book is about labor, about the huge amount of work that motherhood and caregiving is, about the way that we undervalue it, and also its transformative, revolutionary power to drive social change. And you note in your book that, according to a 2020 report by Oxfam, the monetary value of unpaid care work by women ages 15 and older worldwide is at least $10.8 trillion annually. Yeah. How does that undervaluing of care work and mothering manifest in our society today?
Yeah, I think it's important that you said at least 10.8 trillion. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot that figure doesn't even begin to capture. So this is such a big question. We don't value care work, and we really expect it of women. because women, people with female reproductive parts are the people who give birth. So it's sort of convenient to be like, oh, well, while you're taking care of children, why don't you stay in the home and take care of everything else? We have this idea in America that the quote unquote real work is people who go out to an office, right? Or to a factory or to a work site. And we really have never reckoned with the fact that capitalism relies just as much on domestic labor. We sometimes say disparagingly, or we used to say, you know, a stay-at-home mom, as though the home was maintaining itself, right? Dinner was just being cooked by the kitchen, right? Or like the laundry was just doing itself. No, that's real work. That is the work that makes all other work possible. Without being able to feed yourself, bathe yourself, keep yourself healthy, we couldn't go out and do anything. And so it's really to our detriment, right? And we pretend like these things don't matter. And I think that allows our economic system and our culture to take advantage of us, right? And to say we have to hustle all the time, like to prove our worth, we tie identity to work and value, you know, this idea of earning a living, which I just 100% reject. Like when you are born, you're alive, you have a living, right? We don't need to earn a paycheck to like justify our living. We are all deserving of a basic standard of life. Mm-hmm. And what we've normalized in America is a pretty inhumane way of life. You know, other countries who live similarly to us in Europe, they provide paid leave. They provide universal healthcare. They provide affordable childcare and education. And those things are really human rights. And I think that by saying that care work is invisible and that it doesn't matter, we've allowed ourselves to say that somehow human rights are negotiable.
Yeah, and that's part of what makes your book so revolutionary, is it focuses on this idea of deservedness or worthiness, as in what is a human being deserve and what are they worthy of? So this is a really basic question, but what's the answer to that? What does every human deserve in this life?
Oh, I think every human is deserving of health, shelter, love, pleasure. And I mean, that's pretty good. If we can check all of those things, I'd say that's a pretty good life. Yeah, it's not complicated. You know, again, we've really set it up so that those things seem negotiable or somehow those are the things exactly too, by the way, that we give, you know, that most of us are able to give to children. And that's part of what this book is about too. Like the way that we can raise our children is really the way that we can instill values for the next generation. You know, to refer back to that sort of long fight that I was talking about, I do think that there are so many things I want for our country, and I'm not sure that I'm going to live to see them. But rather than give up, I think, well, maybe my daughters will have full body autonomy. Maybe no one will tell them, you know, will force them to become a mother if they don't want to become one. And so a lot of the work that I think about is how do we create a society where our children can thrive and also where our children can be the leaders who improve things and move us towards a more progressive and equitable world. And the work that we do day in and day out to affirm a child, to tell them that they are enough exactly as they are and that everyone is deserving of a good life, no matter what they look like, no matter what their skin color is. No matter what their gender is, those are all things that's the work of parenting. And parenting, to be fair, also feels like a lot of drudgery. It's never ending. Like that's partly what this book is about too. That's how I felt in the pandemic, but it was about reframing things and understanding the significance and the meaning of the work that we are doing as caregivers.
One of the simple acts of mothering that you talk about as being an agent of social change, you use the example of interacting with your daughters and talking about your own body. You were looking back at photos of, you know, your wedding or the time that you and your husband were dating before you got married.
Yeah.
And your daughters looked at the image and then they looked at you. And one of them asked, you know, Mom, did you get fat? And your impulse initially is a normal, how I would feel as well, is to immediately sort of tense up a little bit and then get maybe defensive or embarrassed. But then you took that moment and tell us how you reacted and why.
Yeah. So this is what, I mean, this is where I, in that moment, I was, of course, I was mildly humiliated. And I felt like, oh, this is where the rubber meets the road, right? The sort of, I know that there is, being thin does not make you morally superior, nor does it make you healthier than someone who is fat. And I've known this, it's, you know, through work of loving myself and accepting myself. And I was like, how do I show my children this? And that's a lot of the questions that we all grapple with, right? We're kind of making up parenting on the fly. But I think so many of us are caught between the way we were raised and the way we really want to live. Mm-hmm. And so in that moment, I kind of took a deep breath and, you know, I had told myself before, I don't want my daughters to see me saying disparaging things about my body because they're going to internalize that. I inherited that from my mother who inherited it from her mother who inherited it from colonialism. Right. Yeah. And so I was like, here's a moment where I can try to break that pattern. And so I just swallowed my pride and I said, you know, yeah, I got fat. You know, bodies change. Sometimes they get bigger, sometimes they get smaller, but you know, my body is really good at keeping me alive. And that's really what its job is. And you know, it grew you and I gave birth to you guys. And yeah, that's just what bodies do. And it took a lot of effort to do that, but it was interesting, like, because their reaction was so non-judgmental. They were like, huh, yeah, you did get fat. And then they were like, but I love your squishy tummy. It's like a pillow. Yeah. And then they're just on me, petting me, squealing. And I realized in that moment, like, oh, I'm doing a good job as their parent because they didn't see fat as something negative. They saw fat as an adjective. And it was only me who was bringing that, you know, judgment and that complication to it. And they sort of helped me in that moment, like move closer to really letting go and seeing my body for what it is, which is just this miraculous thing that keeps me alive and that gave them life. And it was cool. And I think, you know, I have to do some of that work every day, right, to remind myself of those things, but it's not as hard for them. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm saying. Like, that's where I see change happening, right? And it is not, we're like overturning all of, you know, our fat phobic patriarchal society, like, but it matters. It matters that these two girls in the world know that being fat is not a bad thing.
And you mentioned the decolonialism layer of this because a lot of that is moving away from this white centric image of slender, blonde, blue eye beauty and mothering, you know, parenting one person at a time, you're able to reframe that for the next generation. I know that this is something that other scholars have talked about, and you really mm-hmm. do a great job of weaving together some of the academia and work by other writers that frame motherhood this way. But it was really such a readable and beautiful weaving between your own memoir and the framing of motherhood as revolution that brought it to, I think, new audiences. And I think it's really exciting to read what you've brought us. Talk to me just a little bit about your Filipinx heritage and the way that your work as a mother, you are trying to lift that layer of colonialism off of what your daughters experience.
Yeah. I was humbled to realize, and I would venture to guess that many parents feel this way, but it was interesting for me to realize that so much of the way I approached my parenting and mothering was in reaction or in conversation with how I myself was mothered. And my parents I'm first generation Filipino. My parents came from the Philippines in 1971 and they came for economic opportunity and they came to, you know, also give their children more opportunities. And I had to wrestle with that. A lot of the things that were my cultural inheritance were things that were not what I personally believed. You know, we were raised Catholic. We were raised being told that being successful and being acceptable meant assimilating into American culture, meant, you know, being high achieving and being legible to white America. And I internalized those things. It was really important for me to be considered smart, right? It's probably partly why I'm a writer, right? Because I was really into grammar and I knew that that was important to prove my success and my value in America. But as I've gotten older, I've started to free myself from those ideas, and I've relied on the scholarship and the writing of Filipinx American writers to realize that that cultural inheritance that we had, we're privileged enough to have been born in America, and we can let go of those standards. We can reject the things that don't serve us. And so in this book, I also wanted to pay homage and pour gratitude towards my parents, because I understand, like, all of this talk of me leaving behind the colonial mindset and dismantling white supremacy, I'm able to do that because to a certain extent, my parents acquiesced to those forces. Mm. And so I understand that, you know, the things that probably I wanted from my parents that I wasn't able to get was because they were so focused on their own survival and giving us a better life. And in a different way, that's what I hope to do for my daughters. I want to do that work of undoing those cultural inheritances that insisted that we were not enough as immigrants, as Filipinx Americans. Our country is getting more diverse, and we need to insist on the worthiness of all people. And so that's what I'm doing to try to move things forward. I think mothering my daughters is, in some ways, I've had to mother myself to get to a place where I can teach them those things and be in touch with my values so clearly enough that I can try to impart them to them.
Ooh, isn't that the journey, mothering yourself in so many ways? The mental health journey is a lot about that, about, you know, thinking of yourself as somebody deserving of care and mothering. You know, in America, the lion's share of low-paid care work is done by women of color.
Yes.
And you saw that on the front lines because your mother was a hospice nurse and went to other people's homes for a good part of your childhood. As you were growing up, you watched her go and care for people during their most vulnerable moments and become so important to those families for the time that she was a part of their lives to help one of their loved ones pass. What did your mother's work and watching that teach you about motherhood and the way that we treat the care industry in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought my mother is amazing, and the sort of feedback, and, you know, she gets Christmas cards. She moved across the country and she still gets Christmas and holiday cards from some of the families that she took care of. I just saw how we talked about bodies and death all the time when I was growing up. And I really feel like her work democratized bodies to me and showed me just how vital care is every day, and the importance of that and the dignity in that work. And, you know, I didn't really set out to write the story of my family in this book, which is odd because it's so essential to it. It's so central to it now. But it was a statistic that I saw in the pandemic, which is that Filipinx nurses are 4% of nurses in the United States, but they comprise 34% of COVID-related nursing deaths.
Wow.
And so, I mean, that statistic hit me so hard because I thought that's my mother. That could have been my mother. That could have been many people I know. And it's plain and simple something that I've understood my whole life, which is that the lives of people of color are considered less valuable than the lives of white people. And, you know, the reason why Filipinx nurses are overrepresented in COVID care, which is ICU and critical care, is because they were willing to take jobs that were more intimate with patients' bodies than white nurses were willing to take. And so I realized that statistic showed me, like, the forces that shaped my mother's life, you know, American colonialism in the Philippines being like the number one thing. They're very, like, my family story is very different from, you know, Black people and African-American people in America whose ancestors were enslaved, right? Like, and which is really, you have to reckon with that when you think about how we devalue care and expect it of women of color.
Yeah.
It really is because of slavery that persists. But I understood in that moment that I think maybe there's somebody else who can tell that story, right? And we need to reckon with the story of slavery in America, but it's the same forces these forces of colonialism, capitalism, racism, white supremacy, they touch many people's lives. And this idea of, you know, devaluing care work and mothers, like that also, that affects white Americans, right? It's not a, it affects everyone and we all suffer underneath it. And so that's why I really wanted to bring that story out, because I also feel like it's underrepresented, but that it turns out this is a thing that's been surprising to me as a writer, to find that the deeper I drill down into my own story that I believe and insist on its value and worthiness, it gets specific, and I would fear that people wouldn't be interested. But it turns out that when you do that, that sort of specificity makes it more universal to people.
Yes.
And more people are able to relate and find their way in. And that's been a surprise and really a gift to me.
You know, I was wondering about gender and terminology in your book. Mm-hmm. And when you refer to mothering and motherhood, who does that include?
Yeah, so I want to think about the ways that we expand our understanding of mothers and mothering. So we tend to think of mother and motherhood as a noun, which is kind of it's static to me. And the real, to me, being a mother is all about action, and it's all about repetitive, sometimes sense deadening action. But the work of caring for, and not just children, you know, like, but any person is acts of service and love to the body. And there's just so many repeated actions. And so I wanted to sort of think about ways of being more inclusive. And, you know, the other thing I'll say is that raising children is a social responsibility. When we invest in children and in families, we are really investing in public health and the future of our country. So I want to find a way for us to understand that. So what I settled on, which is not, I'm not the first person to do this. Writers like Danny McLean and Alexis Pauline Gums and China Martins and Maya Williams have written about this. But if we were to expand, and instead of thinking about this stuff as a noun, we think about it as mother and mothering as a verb, anyone can do that. It's not gender specific. It is not even parent specific. Like, that can include childcare providers, babysitters, nannies, aunties, beloved chosen family, in-laws. There's just no one who can't be involved in the act of mothering. So I want to find a way to call people in to do this work, because again, we can't do it alone. And children and adults benefit from being close to one another and from interacting. And you don't have to want to have children to experience the benefits of having a meaningful relationship with a young person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I should also say that I wrote a book. My first book was called Like a Mother. And I got a lot of feedback from readers who said, you know, I think your book is so important and it means a lot to me. But as someone who does not identify as a mother, you know, I found it really gender exclusive. And I took that to heart. And I think about how I just never want to leave people behind, right? And I'm still learning. And I think that's another thing, is like, I'm always learning. But mother is a very important identity to me, as I know it is for a lot of people, but it requires nothing of me. I give nothing up in talking about mothering. I'm still allowed my very personal understanding and meaningful idea of mother, but I get to share it with more people.
There are a lot of considerations when it comes to what mothers or parents deserve in the U.S. But right now, it seems that our country does not believe that mothers deserve free childcare, that we deserve the ability to raise our children with gender-affirming care in many parts of the country, that we deserve the right to decide whether or not we become parents at all. What do we do with that when we know what we believe every mother deserves or every person deserves, yeah, but the government doesn't agree?
Yeah, we, you know, I think we buckle up, like set our jaw. We know here, I mean, we prepare to show them what we deserve and insist upon it. We can't afford not to. I think here's the thing that gives me some hope, which is that you know, 66% of people who get abortions are already mothers, right? Mothers know the work that is involved. You know, they know the cost. And the majority of Americans support abortion. The majority of Americans think that the minimum wage should be higher. Majority of Americans support paid family leave. So our elected officials are there to represent us. Like, they are failing us. So we will continue to take care of each other. We will provide abortions for one another. We will, you know, set up meal trains. We will set up play dates. We will welcome other children into our home. We will continue to take care of each other. This is the work of survival. Marginalized and oppressed people have been doing this work since America became a country, and even before that, right? So we'll keep doing that. And hopefully in taking care of each other, we can give each other a little bit of energy and a little bit of space to begin to also do the work of advocating. And because we need change at the government level, we cannot let the government off the hook. I don't know exactly how to do that because I know we're all tired, but I know that there are organizations out there who are fighting for paid leave, who are fighting for domestic workers, who are fighting for workers' rights. And, you know, when we're ready, they will welcome us into that fight and we will continue that work.
Your first book, Like a Mother, it was about the science and the history of motherhood. And you said in this book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change, that initially before committing to the project, you had resisted writing another book about motherhood. Why did you feel that way?
Oh, I mean, I find motherhood and mothering endlessly fascinating. You know, it's like life. but I was really aware of how women's stories are treated as niche and they're not valued. Like, I am aware of the ways in which the stories of women and the experiences of women are pushed to the outside. We center men's experiences. And so there was a part of me that just wanted to not have to be pigeonholed. Mm-hmm. But now I've sort of just doubled down because, you know, and the reaction that I've gotten to this book is that this is just the most universal basic stuff. And we've lost sight of the basics of how we get through this life. And so I'm very happy to be writing about motherhood and mothering because I think it is the most important work that humans have to do.
Angela Garbez is the author of the new book, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change. Thank you very much for being here on Soundside.
Thank you, Libby. Thank you for the thoughtful questions.